Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. Resource it in the back. I think we didn't run out of. I printed enough. I'll just tell there's two kinds of sources tonight. There is one booklet over here, one booklet, and there is a timeline, the Esther timeline. All right, it's supposed to be, oh, here you go. You have it in the, you see this one? Yeah, here you go. So this timeline that I made, and I want to thank Priel for printing it and putting this beautiful plastic, but I'm the one that designed it, so I get the credit. I get the credit for that. So thank you, everyone, for coming, and welcome. Welcome for this new series of Esther, which I have a very, I would say, ambitious goal. And my goal in this series is actually to finish the entire book of Esther in five classes. Now, I'll tell you, it's an ambitious goal, but it's not impossible. It's not impossible. I'll tell you how we're going to break down the Megillah. It's going to be very practical here. We're going to read word by word the entire Megillah. All right, how it's going to work in this class. Yeah, so fun, right? In this class, I'm going to read, first of all, the first chapter. We're going to learn it with a long introduction. But from next class, we will do two chapters a class. That means 30 minutes from one chapter, 30 minutes to the other one. All right, so it's all good. If by any chance you can't come to one of the classes, it's crucial that you will come to the other one, to the next one, and that you will listen to the recording. So everything is recorded, and I will send the recording afterwards, so you can listen to it. Now, why do I teach that? Why did I even have this, I would say, idea of teaching Esther? What's so special? So, first of all, you all know that I love teaching Tanakh. I really love teaching Tanakh. That's something that I love to do. This is something that if you ask me what I prefer to teach among all topics, it will be Tanakh for a different discussion. And among all the books of Tanakh, I'll be honest, Esther is my favorite. Here I'm telling you, Esther is my favorite book of all Tanakh, if I can even say that. Now why? First of all, because it's my birthday. My birthday is on Purim. Now you all know, so I expect presents. I'm kidding. First of all, it's my birthday, so every year it was like, oh, when we read the Megillah, I know I have birthdays, all right? And second of all, it's just so good. It's so good. There's so many characters. There's so many twists in the plot. There is so much going on. It's very colorful. You can almost like see it as a Broadway show. I don't know why they made Joseph, and right? And the colorful or technicolor dream code and so on. They should make Esther. Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus and whatever going on and the wine and the humor. That should be a Broadway show. So again, I told you, I can't guarantee there will be wine, but there will be humor, as you can see. There will be humor in this class. I'll tell you, it's going to be ambitious, but we will be able to do that. All right? In 60 minutes, we'll be able to do that. Now, first of all, I want to explain why is it important to learn the Megillah. Before we dive in, why is it important? So two reasons I have for you for that. First thing is halacha-based. The halacha tells us there is a very special halacha only for the Megillah that says we are not allowed to speak or to do any other stuff during laning of Megillah. Why? Because a person, doesn't matter if that's a man or a woman, both of them are equally obligated, has to listen, to hear every and each word of laning, of the Megillah. We don't have it, for example, on Shabbos, when we have the person that goes up and lanes from the Torah. We don't have this halacha that tells us I have to listen to every and each word. In the Megillah, we do have it. And if someone, just for some reason, did not pay attention and missed one word, missed one sentence, he needs to read it by himself again. Because we need to follow word by word. That's for a different discussion. Why? So when it comes to Purim, and we all need to listen to the Megillah, we don't really have time going into commentary, trying and understanding into depth the stories. Why did he do that? Like, we really need to like be as sharp as we can, as focused as we can, to follow the laning of the Megillah. That's the first reason why I think it's very important now, we're a month and a half before Purim, to have this kind of, I would say, opportunity to go and learn step by step the Megillah, because we don't have any other time to do it. That's first. Second of all, the Megillah is built as one big long text, right? It's one big block of text. We don't really understand when one chapter ends, one chapter starts, what exactly is the flow, the plot, how it involves. We don't really understand that. Now, if you've ever participated, we have some new faces here, but some of you already participated in more than one of my series on Tanakh. You know that the way I teach Tanakh is a little bit different than the classic way. The classic way, of learning Tanakh means that I'm going through the words, the verses, the psukim, the chapters, the prakim, then I go through Rashi, the commentators, and so on, and I explain. I teach a little bit different. I also bring commentators, but I also love, first of all, to read the pshat, the simple, plain text. Just to meet the text, read it. What did the text tell? Sometimes we jump already to the commentators and understand what did that commentator say? What did the Ramban, the Rashi? Wait, what did the Torah tell us? What did the Navi or the Ketuvim, the Megillah tell us in the text? So first of all, we will do that. We will read the text and we'll go on. And we'll also do some Midrashim a little bit and some commentators. I'm sure we will not be able to cover all aspects of each perek, but we'll do a decent amount of it. All right, first of all. Second of all, who wrote the Megillah? Who wrote it?
Mordechai.
Why do you think Mordechai? Who wrote the Megillah? Mordechai? Not Mordechai.
Ezra
wore the Megillah. Why Ezra? So take a look. You're close. Ruth, you're close. Take a look in source number one. The Gemara in Baba Batra tells us, list the authors of different books in Tanakh. And the Gemara tells us as follows. Source number one. We skipped the chapter. The members of the Great Assembly wrote the following. Yechezkel, Shnei Masar, which are the 12 books, Daniel, and Megillat Esther. Now, the members of the Great Assembly, who are the members of the Great Assembly? We call them in Hebrew, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. That was the leading authority, spiritual authority of the Jewish nation in around the time of the Second Temple. All right? Now, we need to understand that. Why is that important? Because the book, the Megillah, was not written by Mordechai and Esther. It was written centuries after. Not at the time of the story happened. In other words, when we read the Megillah, we should understand that we're reading something that someone wrote many years after the story happened. And one of the consequences for that is what? Is that maybe it's not historically accurate. Right? Maybe it's not historically accurate, and there is no problem with that it's not historically accurate. We're not learning history. If we want to learn history, and there'll be some history now. Hello, welcome. There's sources on the back. Thank you for joining. If we want to learn history, we will open Persian or ancient Persian writings. We will go to the academy and so on. But if we want to learn the Megillah, we're not learning history. We're learning the Megillah. That's important. When we learn a story that was told by someone who did not experience it firsthand, we need to understand that when we come to talk about the Megillah. And I'll tell you, in the world, in the research world, there's a lot of sayings that maybe this did not happen, maybe that did not happen, maybe this character was not named that, maybe it was named different, maybe that happened differently. I want to put it here, first of all, so what? All right, so I personally don't care if it's not 100% historically accurate because it's not a history book. It has different reasons. We don't read it because it's history. If you want to learn history, we'll open history. If you want to learn Tanakh, we'll open Tanakh. All right? So that put it on the table in that sense. So who wrote it? It's Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Now, also it's important to say before we jump into the text that Esther is the last book of Tanakh. Now you would think, wait, it's not the last book of Tanakh. What's the last book? What's the last book of Tanakh? Why Yov? Interesting. Divrei, okay. So by the order, it's Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim Bet, the second Divrei Hayamim, is the last book of Tanakh, all right? But if we put it on a timeline and we want to see what is the last book of Tanakh, that's not Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim ends when? Who knows? When Cyrus, all right, Koresh, as we say in Hebrew, he gives this amendment, this announcement, declaration, that all Jews can go back to their land and build the second temple. But you know when Purim actually is on the timeline? So that's why I created this timeline over here. All right, so take a look in your timeline. In -597, we have the exile of King Yechoniah. All right, he was exiled by the Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel. He was exiled along with the strong society, the rich people, the learned people, those who were very strong, and all the poor people and those who were not so learned and so educated. He stayed in. He didn't want them to come to the Babylonian kingdom, so he told them to stay in Israel. We know that because we have one fast in our year, in our Jewish calendar, that actually remarks the last Jew that was in Israel. What fast do we have? Gedalia, all right? Tzom Gedalia, we have it on Gimel Tishrei, the third day of Tishrei after Rosh Hashanah. That's a fast that we have the remarks, the killing, the murder of Gedalia ben Achikam, who was the last leader of the Jews, the reminders of Jews after the first temple, all right? So we knew there were still Jews here, but most of the educated, rich people were exiled out of Yehuda, along with their king Yechoniah. The destruction of the temple happened not far later, -586, all right? That's the destruction of the first temple that was more of the 400 years, built by King Shlomo, King Solomon, and lasted all the way to -586. Then, not much later, in -583, we have the Cyrus Cylinder, which is what I just told you about. If you go to London, you can see it. The Cyrus Cylinder is the cylinder, the announcement, the declaration that Cyrus, King Cyrus said, all Jews, not only Jews, but we look at that from a Jewish perspective, all nations under this Babylonian /Persian kingdom should and can go back to their homelands to build and worship their own build their temples and worship their own gods. Why he did it and so on, there's a lot of answers. It's not that he was a very loved Jews so much that he wanted them to go back, but he did that, and that's not much later. So Jews were able to go back, and you know who came back first? Not the rich people, not the educated people, but those who came back are actually those poor ones. The ones that left Israel at last are the one to first return to Israel. And that happened in -516. They are the one that built the second temple. So take a look. We don't understand that. But between the destruction of the first temple and the build of the second temple, we have 70 years. That's all. 70 years. There are a lot of people that lived to see both temples. 70 years. Now we talk to ourselves and we say, oh, we wish, we pray, we want the third temple, right? How many years since the second temple was destroyed? More than 1,000? More than 2,000? Between the two temples, there were 70. Just putting that as to think about it. When we talk about a third, is that a third? Can we name it? Can we count it as a third temple? Or is that something new? A new counting. Maybe we should not call it Beit Mikdash Lishi. Maybe we should call it something else. It's not a third one. Like World War I, then World War II, right? How many years in between?
20.
20, right? Now, let's say, God forbid, it's not going to happen, but if, God forbid, in the future, there might be, what will we call it, World War II, 3? Why? If there's 2,000 years in between, it's a new war. Why are we keeping on counting it, all right? Just put that in the back of your mind when we talk about the third temple. Why is it third, all right? So they built in -516, and then look what happened. In -485, the story of Purim. Now we don't understand that, folks. There's a story of Purim, Mordechai and Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus. All this happens when there is already a temple in Yerushalayim. All the Jews that live in Shushan, and we'll talk about this a lot in this series, they leave out of Israel when Israel is built, when there is already a second temple up. Nothing holds them back from moving to Israel, making Aliyah, and joining their brothers in Israel. Sounds familiar? Sounds familiar. History returns all the time, right? So we'll talk about that a lot. Because I want to claim, and I'll claim it throughout the series, that Mordechai and Esther, I would say that very carefully, I don't think, and I'll try to prove it throughout those five classes, I don't think the Megillah is in a big favor of them. I think we can find strong criticism against Mordechai and Esther for different reasons why. Throughout the Megillah, and I will go through all of this in this class.
Except for the last chapter.
Okay. Might be also, I would say, just saying, Ratzui Lerovichav. We say on Mordechai, for most of his brothers, he was like, not everyone. Why do you mention it? It's not everyone. Why do you say, oh, most of the brothers, most of the people of his friends of Mordechai liked him? Most of them? He saved the entire nation. Why most of them? What about the others that don't like him? Why don't they like him? There's a lot to be said. Also in the ending of the Megillah. I'll just continue. Then if there is questions, I'll take. All right? So we say that Purim is the last book in Tanakh. Now what about Hanukkah? What about Hanukkah? When is Hanukkah? So Hanukkah is later than Purim. All right? Hanukkah is later than Purim. Hanukkah, you see, is -164. It's almost 300 years after Purim. But Hanukkah is not in Tanakh. Hanukkah is not in Tanakh. So yes, Hanukkah is our, I would say, the newest holiday we have in our Jewish calendar. It is the newest one. If we don't count Lag BaOmer, Tu Bishvat, or Yom HaAtzmaut, all right? which Yom HaTzmaut is not less than Purim and Hanukkah. There's also Al HaNisim in different shuls in Israel that say, not here, unfortunately. We can talk that, about that in other time. But Hanukkah is the newest one. -164. All right? But, again, it's not in Tanakh. So, in that being said, Esther is the last book in Tanakh. And actually, I'm not the only one who says it. The Gemara says it. Take a look in source number 2. The Gemara in Yuma says as follows, 29a. Source number 2. Just as the dawn is the conclusion of the entire night, so too Esther was the conclusion of all miracles. The Gemara says it. And again, the Gemara was not so much after. A couple of hundred years after. All right? So again, we know that Esther was the last book of Tanakh. All right, so now it's good to start. We'll dive into the text. We're 7:20. We have enough time. We'll dive into the text. Now, when I told you that the book of Esther is a block of text which we don't understand what's going on, we have no clue why and how and who and what, who's against who. Like, okay, that's a story, a plot. I'll tell you that we're wrong. We're wrong. Because every book in Tanakh should be learned not only by its content, but also by its formation, its structure. How is the book written? And just to give you an example why the book of Esther is not just one long text, take a look at this beautiful diagram that I brought over here in source number 3. This I took from Herzog website, Professor Jonathan Grossman. If you came to my classes, you know that I like to quote him a lot already. Here it's also Dr. Rabbi Yehuda Reis. And they together built this structure. They call it the tables were turned, or in Hebrew, Venahafochu. Right? We say in Purim, Venahafochu. Take a look what's going on. We're not going to read the entire thing now, because we're going to see it also throughout the series. But take a look. They found that the Megillah is, I would say, can be divided by two halves. It's actually reflecting, two sides that reflect each other. Take a look, for example, we open with an introduction, right? The Megillah opens with an introduction, we'll do it today. Introduction of Ahasuerus and his kingdom and the feast. And it ends up, the conclusion ends up in chapter number 10 with, again, a conclusion about who? Ahasuerus, right? Then, for example, we have Ahasuerus hosts a feast for all provinces, right? And a special feast is held for the residents of Shushan. And the other side of it is the Jews in all provinces feast in celebration, and a special feast is held by the residents of Shushan. At the end of the Megillah, you see, there is actually reflection. Every and each part of the Megillah has a reflected side on the end of the Megillah. The Megillah was written not just randomly, different stories one after the other. There was thought that Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the great assembly people, put into how to write the Megillah. Not only what to write in the Megillah. It comes all the way to number 8. What they write number 8, which is chapter number 6, with everything turned around. And this is the climax of the Megillah, which says, that night the king could not sleep. This means that Haman leads Mordechai on the royal horse. And we'll talk about that. This is where everything turns upside down. At that moment. But until then you see, we go back again. If number 7 here is Haman consults with his optimistic advisor, then number 9, Haman consults with his pessimistic advisors. All right, we'll see all of this. It's really a reflection, I would say, a symmetric kind of plot that is reversed. V'nahafochu, the tables were turned. You'll see it throughout the series as we go. So let's start reading with the beginning of Megillat Esther. I'll grab some water. I'll read in English, all right, even though I would prefer reading in Hebrew, but I'll read in English, which is now it's a good opportunity to read the Megillah in English also, not only hearing the Hebrew, all right? I will apologize, first of all, if I mispronounce any of the words, all right? As you can hear, English is not my first language, so please help me if I'm stuck in something, all right? I'm not offended by corrections on it or anything, so please do that. All right. So the Megillah opens as follows. In the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Shushan, the castle, or the capital, I'll explain in a minute, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officers, the servants, the army of Persia, and Media, the nobles, and officers of the provinces being before him. Let's pause for a moment. Let's pause for a moment, trying to understand what's going on here. First of all, first thing we see, the Megillah doesn't open with Mordechai and Esther. Not with Haman also. We open with Ahasuerus. It sounds like The point of view of Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the great assembly, when they wrote the Megillah, was not Mordechai and Esther, was Ahasuerus. Why? Why is it important for us to know about Ahasuerus? He's not Jewish. He's wicked. We don't like this king. We'll see in a minute. Do we like him or not? But why do you open with Ahasuerus? So first of all, let's try and ask, who is Ahasuerus? Who is Ahasuerus? So in the research world, there's two answers for that. Who is Ahasuerus, actually? Take a look over here. I brought two pictures. They might look the same, but they're not the same. They're actually two different kings. that's how it looks like. Yeah, not so many details. Take a look at those two kings. All right, there's two answers. Who was Ahasuerus? Because Ahasuerus is not the Persian word. All right, so we need to understand. So one answer, which most of the researchers support, is the gray one, which you pronounce it as I say it here. How do you pronounce it? Xerxes. Thank you. Xerxes or Xerxes. Now you can, in Hebrew I would say Xerxes, all right? As like Mexican also pronounce X as Shin in that sense, because it goes all the way back to this language. By Xerxes, all right, who lived from 485 to minus 485 to minus 465, all right? Some would say he was the ruler of Persia, the Persian kingdom, and so on. Some would say this is Ahasuerus. Other researchers, not most of them, but some of them, say he's actually his successor, which is Artaxerxes. Yeah, exactly. All right. Or in Hebrew, we'll say Artaxerxes. All right. Artaxerxes in Hebrew. Who followed him, who was the one that succeeded him, his son, actually. All right. Who succeeded him. Now, we're not sure exactly, but I'll tell you two things if you want to support it. The Midrash, source number 4, Esther Rabbah, which again, not many years after. The Midrash is dated to Second Temple. All right. Not many years after. The Midrash, source number 4, says as follows. Rabbi Levi said, Ahasuerus is Artaxerxes. All right, which is Artaxerxes, this the other one. So we have a Jewish opinion that says, you know who Ahasuerus is? Ahasuerus is this one, the brown guy that we have over here, this fellow. All right. However, why do most researchers think it's not him? First of all, it makes more sense with the time. All right. And second of all, I don't think I brought it here, but at the end of the Megillah, we have a pasuk here. I wrote it for me here. We have a pasuk that says as followed: Vayasem Hamelech. Ahasuerus, mas al haaretz ve'yam, that the king Ahasuerus put tax over the land on the sea. Ahasuerus, not Ahasuerus, it's called Ahasuerus. Now there is a halachic question: when the person that goes and lands the Megillah, how should he pronounce the word Ahasuerus or Ahasuerus? Now Ahasuerus is exactly Xerxes. Sorry, I will not be able to pronounce it in English. Right? I will not be able. So again, the Megillah itself calls him like this king. So we see different sources. The rabbi says it's the followers, the successor. The Megillah itself calls him like the father. We don't know exactly, but it's probably one of those two. Now, fortunately, we have a lot of sources from the Persian world about those two kings. And we can see that both of them really, really liked two things the most. Wine and women. Wine and woman, that's what those two kings liked the most. All right? Not talking about politicians today, but those two kings liked wine and woman. And in our Megillah, Ahasuerus is a king that loves wine and women. Right? That's Ahasuerus. So it makes much sense that the story is true as we talk about the accuracy of the story and so on. All right? Now, the 127 countries, lands. So it's not exactly according to history 127, but it's huge. It is from India to Ethiopia. Take a look over here. I brought the picture. That's not from a Jewish website. That's from the academia, where they research the kingdom, the Persian kingdom. They want to see 127 countries? Yeah. Take a look. All the way from Western India of today, all the way including Eretz Israel, all the way until northern Africa, all the way southern from Egypt, where Ethiopia, the northern part of Ethiopia is today. That was how big the kingdom was. All right, just to understand that 127, maybe it's not exactly 127. What exactly? Why do we say 127 and so on? I would give one answer that I saw. What else do we have in Tanakh with the number 127?
Sarah.
Thank you. Sarah lived 127 years, right? And we know the famous Rashi on the first pasuk that says, right? How does it say, right? V'yichai Sarah 127 shanim. We break it down, right? Kizu, he was 100 or 7 is beauty and 20 was the sin and so on. So I saw one answer given by Michael Eisenberg, who's an Israeli author, and he said maybe the reason that the Megillah says 127 is to allude, again, because it was written by people who already had Tanakh in their hands. Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the Great Assembly, had Tanakh in their hands. They could open Parshat Chayisara and see what's going on. And they saw that she lived 127 years. They wanted to allude to this. In what way? I'm not so sure. But maybe they wanted to allude to that. Just think about if there's any connection between Sarah and Ahasuerus that they wanted to do here. And that says 127. Yeah.
The Gemara Rabbi Akiva goes on to explain exactly that connection.
Sarah and Ahasuerus.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.
127.
The 127. Here we go. Shkoich. Shkoich. Now, just to understand that we talked about the Jews, right? So we said that the Jews that live in that time, they were the wealthier Jews. The Jews, the educated ones, those who have businesses in the Persian kingdom, those who didn't decide not to go back to Israel when they could, hundreds of years ago, those who were rooted in the Persian kingdom, and that makes sense that they will go and join Ahasuerus in his feast. All right? And we know that they do that. Let's continue reading a little bit. Let's continue what happened in this feast. So in verse 4, when he displayed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his splendid majesty for many, many days, 180 days. Now, 180 days of drinking? Well, what's going on here? 188 in 80 days. So again, the researcher world, the academy world, doesn't see any records of any feast that happened in Shushan, which is a real city around Iran of today, didn't see any records of 180 days of feast. What do we actually see? We see that Ahasuerus, if we say it's the first king and not the second one that we saw, we know today that he fought a lot of battles in order to survive in this large, vast kingdom. All right, one of those battles is called the Battles of Thermopylae. I don't know if you've heard a little bit about it. We have some history teachers over here. So the Battle of Thermopylae, also that the battle that Ahasuerus has fought, and so on. And he needed, according to what I can offer you, he needed the appreciation, I would say, of all his ministers, of all his officers, before he went out to this battle. Now, this battle doesn't appear in the Megillah. But between the first chapter and the second chapter, we have 4 years. We don't understand that. 4 years between the first and the second one. And in those 4 years exactly, there's a lot of battles that the Ahasuerus is fighting. So I want to offer, based on Rabbi Ben Elau, that maybe we should say that this feast is not just love of wine and women and let's just have fun and hang out. Maybe there's also political, I would say, reasoning behind it. Maybe it makes sense. Maybe we should say that Ahasuerus wanted to bring his officers and his servant and so on to display, as it says, when he displayed the riches of his glorious kingdom, he knew he needed their support, political support, in going out to those very hard battles just 1 year later and fighting for 4 years. Maybe we should say that as well. And when the days, in verse 5, and when these days were complete, those 180 days, the king made a feast for all the people who were present in Shushan, the castle or the capital. Pause here. Why is Shushan the castle or the capital? In Hebrew it says, Shushan HaBira. Shushan HaBira, right? As we read it. What is Bira? Two meanings. Castle or capital. Castle, Yerushalayim HaBira, right? But Bira in Hebrew is also castle. So we're not exactly sure if Shushan HaBira is only the people from the castle or is it everyone else. The Midrash and the Gemara in Masechet Megillah, I understand it as everyone because it says, take a look in source number 5, I think it's supposed to be. The Megillah, the Masechet Megillah and the Talmud, based on the Midrash, says as follows. In source number 6. No, where do we have it? We don't have it. I didn't bring it, right? Okay, I didn't bring it. Sorry. Anyhow, you need to believe me that the Megillah, you'll have to believe me that that the Gemara said that the Jews were punished. Why? Because they also joined this feast, all right? And that was their sin, that they joined the feast. So we know that the Gemara understands that it was for all the people in the city of Shushan, and they all came and celebrated for 7 days under the feast of Ahasuerus, all right? So let's continue. It's not only the capital. Yeah, you have to believe it. And when these days were complete, the king made a feast for all the people who were present in Shushan, the castle or the capital, from great to small, 7 days in the courtyard of the garden of the king's house. This makes more sense to be a feast and not only something political. It's 7 days. 7 days is something we see in ancient Persian texts and recordings that kings were celebrating for 7 days, right? We have it also in a Jewish life, right? Sheva Brachos, for example. So on 7 days, we know that. White, fine cotton, and blue, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver, rods and marble pillars, couches of gold and silver upon a floor of alabaster, marble, pearl, and black onyx. Very rich, right? Very, very rich. Who would not want to celebrate in that? Now, folks, why is it important for us to know that? Why is it important for us to understand what exactly are the materials that the feast and the castle and the dishes were made out of? Take a look what I highlighted. I highlighted blue, fine linen, and purple. Now, folks, go again to source number 5 this time. This time it does appear. And 6, sorry. And in source number 6, I brought from Divrei Hayamim one example. When we talk about Beit HaMikdash, about the temple, the first temple of Shlomo HaMelech. Take a look at what it says. And Shlomo HaMelech made the veil of blue and purple and crimson and fine linen and wrought cherubim thereon. All right, that's the English. Folks, we need, and I think that the author of the Megillah wants to allude by telling us all those materials to allude to the first temple, to understand that the Jews that participated in this feast, they forget about the real thing. They forget about all the materials they saw. They don't, do you remember? They didn't tell to themselves, oh, buddy, do you remember that those purple and this linen and those materials were actually part of the temple that we just worshipped it? Don't you remember that? What's going on here? We're already hundreds of years after the first temple. The second temple is already built. For your reminders, and the Jews just sit there in Canada, sorry, in Shushan, and enjoy the wonderful life that they have, along with the king, very close to the plate, around the table. What's the problem here? I think we're told about those materials just because of that. Let's continue reading, because it's not the only allusion that we have to Beit HaMikdash. Let's continue. And he gave in verse 7, and he gave them to drink in golden vessels. Vessels of all different types. And the royal wine was in abundance in accord with the king's power. That's how we read it. You understand the difference in the tune if you paid attention. And pay attention this time if you haven't paid attention yet. When we read the Megillah, we change the tune a little bit when we get to this pasuk. When we get to the pasuk, we slightly turn the tune from being from happy Purim kind of melody to the set of Tisha B'Av. Now why? Why do we do that? Because the Kelim Mekelim Shonim, those different golden vessels, what is different vessels? Why should we know that? So the Gemara already tells us, you can see it in source number 7, I'm not going to read it inside. The Gemara tells us, after based on the Midrash, you know what are those vessels? They're vessels that Achashverosh received already from his grandfather, who received from Nebuchadnezzar, who stole it from the Mikdash. Those Jews sat and ate around a table using vessels and utilities from the Mikdash, not even caring about what's going on here. You want to tell me this is not criticism against the Jews in Shushan? I bet you it is criticism against them. For sure it is. I don't think the Megillah is in favor of them. I don't think they're so great as we think they will be. And we're not getting Mordechai and Esther, who are their leaders. All right? So we see that there is a lot of illusion here that Anshei Knesset HaGdolah wanted to teach us, look about the situation, a reality, where there is a lot of Jews in Israel, mostly uneducated, not so rich, who struggle to build and maintain the second temple, and the high society, the rich people, the educated class, sits and enjoys the feast of Achashverosh in Paras, forgetting what happened just a couple of years ago. Yeah.
But there is also the political dimension that had they not gone, it may have been a slap in the face to the king. So you have to sort of weigh that possibility.
I agree. But again, as I'm saying, if I'm not going through history here, just as the Megillah is written, I don't see why would the author of the Megillah would tell us all of these details. No. I would assume he tells us those details because he wants us to understand that something is bad, something stinks, in this culture, in the Jewish cultures of Shushan. Something is not as it's supposed to be. And we'll see when we get to chapter 2, for example, and I'm spoiling, that's a spoiler alert here for next week. When we get to talk about Mordechai and Esther, think about their names. Mordechai, Ben Shim'i, Ben Kish, Ish Yemini. It's like saying in our time, think about Christopher, son of Reuven, son of Shimon, son of, Mordechai in our times. Mordechai is not a Jewish name, folks. They're calling his son Christopher. Mordechai is named after Morduch, was a Babylonian god, idol. Esther is not a Jewish name. Her Jewish name is Hadassah. Esther is Esterika. That's one of the gods. Or Ashtar, different, depends which god. But it's Persian, Babylonian gods. The names of the Jews, they were already assimilated. Mordechai himself assimilated into the world, into the Persian culture. Esther herself assimilated into that culture. The Jews forgot from their Jewish identity. We'll talk more about it next week. You'll see and I'll prove you. Mordechai was already in Israel and decided to go back and return to Paras. He was already there and he said, oh, that's not for me. Let me go back to my life in Paras, in Shushan. I prefer that better, to be close to the king. My job, I think, we'll talk about all this next week. I just wanted to for us to understand that we should read the Megillah in a critical way, in a critical reflection, that the Jews in Shushan and Paras were not so perfect. And I think the Megillah has some things to say about that. Let's continue reading. And then verse 8, and the drinking was according to the law. There was no coercion. So the king had instituted that all the officers of his house should do according to every man's desire. There's a lot of wine, as much as you want. You can take more and more and more. Now, why did I highlight the word law? The word law in Hebrew here is dat. V'hashtiya chadat ein ones. Now, what is the word dat? Dat is law, right? Dati, like person who is dati, religious. Religion is law. At the end of the day, all right? Different laws that someone obeys. Someone goes and lives accordingly. Now, that the first time we have the word dat in the Tanakh is here. No. Yeah? I'm telling you, Linda. The first time we have the word dat in the Tanakh appears here. Why? The word dat comes from the word data. We know data, for example, which is facts, right? Information, laws, and so on. That comes all the way from the Persian word called data. Data is law in ancient Persian. Now, inside the Megillah, we have a lot of Persian words. Not the Megillah is not written only in Hebrew. Today, it's already Hebrew. But if it's for unshaken Neset HaGdolah, if we go back to the eyes of the authors, and they said to themselves, wait, what word should we use? They decided to put inside Persian words inside the Megillah. We don't understand that when we read the Megillah. We don't pay attention for that. Now, what's the reason? Why would the author want to add and include Persian words inside the Megillah? What I want to claim again, they want to give us the atmosphere that something is not so Jewish here.
Assimilated.
Exactly. They speak already. Even the book itself has some Persian language inside. Now, I brought just for, because I thought someone would say that, but no one said it yet. We have one word dat in the Torah, before the Megillah, and this is in Vezot HaBracha. All right? Someone here lanes Vezot HaBracha, the last part in the Torah. Take a look in source number 8. The right side, we say, "Ba v'zarach miseir lama ofia mehar paran ve'ata mirvavot kodesh miyemino esh dat lamo." All right, we say that it's part of Zod HaBracha, the first Aliyah, the last parsha of the Torah, which we read on Simchas Torah, esh dat. However, and by the way, in all the English translations, esh dat is the fire of law. I checked Art Scroll and Koran and this, whatever. It's all law. They all translate the word esh dat as law. Unfortunately, and I'm going to say it again, when we read the Torah in English, we miss a lot, folks. We miss a lot. Because in every translation, there is interpretation. And unfortunately, I would say, in this case, the interpretation, the translation is just wrong. Esh dat is not two words. Because if you take a look in the Torah, and you will open the Torah, because I'm laying Vezot HaBracha usually, and you will see how the word is written, take a look in the left side. Esh dat is one word. Not two words. Esh dat is one word. What happened that through all the generations in the printed Chumashim, it was printed two words, we can talk. But Eshdat is one word. It's called Asda, for example. All right? When we have different places in the Torah that we see the word Ashda or Ashdat, which means a place, a hill, a small place, that's a hill of fire. It's not dat. The word debt is totally Persian. I only brought it as an insurance if someone would ask me about Rizot Abracha. But no one asked me so far, so it's all good. But the word debt appears only the first time in Esther, appears like 22 things in the book of Esther, a little bit in the book of Ezra. Yeah, Terry. Because in Hebrew, that turned to be a Hebrew word. Because it appears in our Tanakh. But it wasn't Hebrew in the times of Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. It wasn't Hebrew back then. And they decided to include non-Hebrew words. That's not the only non-Hebrew word. There's a lot. I just brought this as an example. Again, it's the kind of things that we don't understand. We can't appreciate and pay attention when we only listen to the Baal Kor Elaine's the Megillah in Purim, because we don't see that. But there's a lot of wisdom behind the words. Let's continue. I'm telling you, there is much, much, much more. Then you see why it's my favorite book. Not only because of my birthday, just reminding everyone again. Now we get to some trouble, right? So far it's a Chashverosh, there is a feast, and so on. Verse 9. And Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house of King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the king's heart was merry with wine, he said to Mehuman, Biztah, Harvona, Bikta, Vagata, Zetar, and Harkas, the seven eunuchs, or Sarisim in Hebrew, all right? I have the Megillah in my mind when I read Shivata Sarisim, Roi Penei HaMelech, all right? Those eunuchs, right? They sing it incorrectly. Those eunuchs who served the king Ahasuerus to bring Vashti, the queen, before the king in the royal crown to show the people and the officers her beauty, for she was beautiful. Oh, 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 oh. Something wrong is going to happen here. The first problem, the first twist in the plot. Everything looks beautiful. Everything looks amazing. There's gold. There's marble. There's wine. There's a lot of things. But still, the king wanted something more. And he wanted his queen, Vashti, to come in. Now, who's Vashti? Again, because we're also doing some history. Before we get into the meaning of the story, who's Vashti in that sense? Vashti has different ideas, different meanings to her name. One of the meanings of Vashti in ancient Persian is Vahishti. Vahishti in ancient Persian, we know it today, means the best. The best in ancient Persian, the best, whatever that is Vahishti. So some say, some researchers that they research and they study the Persian language, they would say that Vashti means the best, and now that's a Hebrew way of changing the word Vahishti, but that was her name. We have other characters with their name. Other example is that her name has, it's a combination of two different names. One is two different words. One is Vash, which means desired. Vash in ancient Persian is desired. And Ti means now. All right? Current, in present tense. So that means she is desired now. Some say this is kind of her name. And then if we go according to the second name, we should understand that maybe that's not her real name, but that's the name that Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the big assembly, the great assembly, wanted to call her because she is desired now to the king. All right? Yeah.
I think I've read also that she was Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter.
Exactly. Exactly. She wasn't a very good person, but again, I would say that in modern world, in modern commentary on the Tanakh, Moses, a feminist one, they turned Vashti into this role of this woman that stands on her principles and says, I'm not going to go to the king because I have my own rights and I'm not going to do whatever he wants. She was not feminist, all right, for different reasons why. We don't really know, according to the Megillah, why. But it's a good thing to say that we're not sure. So the Midrash gives different examples of why exactly Vashti refused to go to the king. We'll see it in a minute. I just want to say why there even a feast for women. Aren't their kohet, like what their Orthodox feasts, right? Like what's going on in the feast? So first of all, we know that the feasts were mixed. How do we know that? Because when we reach to chapter, for example, 5 and 6 and 7, then we see that Esther is inviting Haman and Ahasuerus to her feast. So there were men and women together. So why are there two? Why are they separated? Why are there separated feasts in that sense? I would say in that sense, that, and again, I see it in Dat Mikra. I see that I wrote here in my notes. It comes from Dat Mikra, from Rabbi Amos Chacham, who wrote this modern commentary on Megillat Esther, that according to different recordings, Persian recordings, we know that after 7 days of feast, where you drink a lot of wine, there was kind of, I would say, a tradition where the men asked the women to leave the feast because they wanted to have their own time doing, imagination can continue and figure out what they wanted to do. And a lot of times what they wanted to do is to ask the women to come and join them later on. All right, in whatever they wanted to do. So according to Rabbi Amos Chacham, what he thinks is that, okay, the reason there was, it was mixed throughout the times, but after those 7 days, Vashti separated with all the women to a different place, and then Ahasuerus wanted her to come. Now, why did it say and mention, and I highlighted it, he mentioned all the names of all the servants, right? Mehuman, Biztachar, Vona, Bikta, Bakta, Zetar, and Charkas. Why do we need to know all the names of all the servants? Just say he's told his servants, go and bring Vashti. I wanna say again, based on what I saw by Rabbi Dr. Benny Lau, he says that you know what happens here when the Megillah tells us all the names of all the servants? It tells us that it was something official. It tells us that Ahasuerus, in an official ceremony, in front of everyone, brought his servants and commanded them, go and bring Vashti to me now. It's more than just a spontaneous kind of request. He wanted everyone to see, after he was very, very, very drunk, he wanted everyone to see how beautiful his wife is. So he gathered all the people around, he brought his closest servants and told them, please go and bring my wife. That's a command, that's an order. Everyone saw it. The reason we know it is because he called them, one after the other. And now we should understand what happened, why he becomes so angry when she doesn't want to come. Because she refuses to come and she embarrasses him in front of his entire kingdom. Because he called everyone in this official ceremony telling them, oh, you will see now my wife. And he's waiting minute after minute after minute. And she's not coming. She's not coming. She's not coming. Then they're coming back and saying, I'm sorry, king. She said she wouldn't come. And everyone are waiting. Everyone are watching. Right? One second, Steve. Everyone are watching. So we can understand why he was so angry, why he was so furious. Let's read her her refusal. So in verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's word conveyed by the eunuchs, right? Eunuchs, thank you. And the king was very angry and his wrath burned within him. Two things that I want to say. Take a look, first of all, Queen Vashti. How was she called so far? Vashti the queen. What's the difference between calling someone Vashti the queen or Queen Vashti? What's the difference? Why the change here? Again, we need to ask about every word here has a meaning behind. Yeah.
It's positive and negative. It's like when they say Yaakov and Esau.
You know? Thank you. Positive and negative. And I would also say, I think there is kind of honor. Thank you. Yichus. Queen Vashti. Right? Queen Elizabeth. Not Elizabeth the queen. Queen Elizabeth. Queen Vashti. Now she's in a royal position where she refuses. It's not just Vashti the queen like any other queen. He probably had many more wives. Yes. This is Queen Vashti, the one and only who refuses to Ahasuerus to come. Yes. Think about those different words. Think about those different names. Yeah.
Well, it emphasizes that she was royalty without him.
Exactly.
She was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar.
And she says, well, I don't need this drunk king in order to know who I am. I know who I am. I'm coming from Nichos. I'm the daughter, I'm the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Why do I need this king to tell me what to do, right? Like, I don't need him. We have a different couple. And again, I think this story alludes to a different couple where the king sounds very strong and has a lot of land in Tanakh, but his wife is actually stronger than him. Yeah. Who? Achav. Thank you. Achav and Izebel. We talk about Melachim, the end of Melachim Aleph, the beginning of Melachim Bet. All right? We talk about King Achav, who is very, very strong and very successful. He rules for 40-something years. But he has a wife, Izebel, Jezebel, at his home, at his palace, that she does everything for him, and she really doesn't care about what's going on with him. She thinks she's the real queen, she's the real king. She's the one that wears the pants in the castle. Alright? So again, when Anshei Knesset HaGdolah already have Tanakh in front of their eyes, and they write this kind of relationship between the king and the queen, I'm sure, maybe I'm wrong, but I think, and I'm sure, that they had in their mind Izebel and Achav in front of the right. So she refuses, all right?
Vatimayin.
It says Vatimayin, exactly. Vatimayin happens more than one. It happens also when the woman, for example, doesn't want to do something. For example, about Chalitza and so on, we have Mi'un. So we have the word Vatimayin in Hebrew also in other places, also in Yosef. We just read it in 2 weeks ago, right?
Potiphar was a eunuch.
And
Potiphar was a eunuch as well.
He was a oh, here you go. He was a Saris. Here you go. So maybe it also alludes to that. Who knows? There is some comparison between Yosef not telling his identity in Egypt and Esther not telling, revealing her identity in Shushan. But we're not going to get into that. We don't have a lot of time. Let's continue. His wrath burned within him. I'll just say in Hebrew, it says Chamato ba'arabo. Chamato. Now, chamato has two different meanings. Chama means also wrath, means he's anger, furious. But chama also means what?
Heat.
Okay, this is, okay, chama is heat, but not in that sense, you're right. Chema, what it means? Or the word chema also, you know what it means in ancient Hebrew? Wine. Wine. Chamato barabo, for example, hangover in Hebrew, you know what the word? Chamarmoret. The word hangover in Hebrew is chamarmoret. This shoresh, chet mem reish, also chamato means also wine. So maybe it's not just he was furious, his wine spoke instead of him, right? Maybe we should say that. He's Terry, not Terry Wine, but the wine spoke instead of him. Sorry, Terry. Every time I say wine, I'm looking at Terry so she will not get furious, right? Chamata ba'araba. I hope that's not wine what you have there, yeah? Kidding. Okay, it's all good. Not checking the entrance. Sorry?
Chama is also your mother-in-law.
Yes. You're right. Maybe his mother-in-law was furious. Maybe you see, I told you there's going to be humor. Yeah. Maybe his mother-in-law was also furious. All right. So the king said in verse 13, the king said to the wise man who knew the times, for so was the king's custom to consult with all who knew law and judgment. First of all, you see, he doesn't get decision by himself. He goes and consults with other people. Like, his wife just refused to come. He doesn't know what to do. So he goes to other people. Like, he's a strong king of 127, but like the Megillah tells us he's nothing, right? How strong can he be outside, but how weak can he be in his own palace? Think about the character of the king.
Wasn't he supposed to be have been a barber? I think that's how
in what sense? Like this fat king with the beard that drinks a lot of wine.
That's how he got started, I think. That's
maybe it comes from Ahasuerus, right? Yeah, the king that is only drinking and drunk and really doesn't know what's going on. Even though according to history, that's not exactly true. He loved wine and women, but he was also a very strong leader in his general in the war. Let's continue. You said that. The king, and let's continue. This is recorded. The king said to wise men from who he knew for times, for so was the king's custom to consult with all who knew law and judgment. And those close to him were Karshena, Shetarat, Matat, Oshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memuchan, the seven officers of Persia, and Medai, those who saw the king's face and said first in the kingdom, the people that are close to him. All right, again, seven names. I'm not going to talk about it now, but take a look if you have time afterwards. Try to compare those seven to the other seven. All right, you'll see some of them are repeating themselves. All right, continue. Don't do it now. You want to follow with me. According to law, all right, what shall we do to Queen Vashti? Since she has not done the bidding of King Ahasuerush, conveyed by the eunuchs. Memuchan answered before the king and the officers. He's the one that steps forward, Memuchan. Not against the king alone was Vashti the queen sinned, but also against all the officers and all the people that are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerush. Again, it was a ceremony. It was a public thing. Everyone saw it. And he says, not only you, I'm going to go back home tonight for my wife. What would she tell me? That she's not going to cook dinner for me? Because she's talking, Queen Vashti not going, coming to... My wife will refuse to be over whatever I told her. Now again, we need to understand that the woman's status, I would say the level, the status of woman in the ancient Persian society was the lowest possible. I brought over here Herodotus in source number, because we don't have a lot of time, and I have to bring it. Herodotus in source number 10, one of the ancient historical recordings that we have from the time, says as followed. We'll continue. Just look. Let's see the last verse. The last verse, all right? Or no, let's see everything. Masiste, son of Darius, who happened to have been present at the Persian disaster, doesn't matter what exactly is the context, revealed the admiral Artintes very bitterly, telling him with much beside that such generalship as his proved him worse than a woman, and that no punishment was too severe for the harm he had done the king's estate. Now it is the greatest of all taunts in Persia to be called worse than a woman. We see it in non-Jewish records that the woman was the lowest of the lowest of the world, lowest in society. So think now what this Memuchan, when he goes to the king and says, oh my goodness, what happened here? For the first time, there is a woman that really has an opinion and she really doesn't want to do something. Now what's going to happen? It's the worst of all wars that can happen. He can win all the battles with other enemies, with external enemies, but they will not be able to defeat their own wives in their own homes. All right? So let's continue. And he says as follows. Oh, where am I? Here we go. And he says as follows. Memuchan answered before the king of the officers, not verse 16, not against the king alone was Vashti the queen seen, but also against all the officers and all the peoples that are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, for the queen's word will go out to all the women, causing them to view their husbands with contempt, saying, King Ahasuerus said to bring Vashti the queen before him, but she did not come. So they will do the same, right? And this day, the noble woman of Persia and Madai Media, who heard the queen's word, will say likewise to all the king's officers, and there will be more than enough scorn and anger. Now again, Ahasuerus for himself didn't really know what to do. He was so drunk, he didn't know what to do. Then this Memuchan comes, and he's not worried about Ahasuerus' respect. He's worried about his own troubles, right? About his own troubles in his own house. That what brings them to tell him, oh, wait, you should have to do something with her. It just can't be, right? And it continues. If it pleases the king, in verse 19, if it pleases the king, let a royal edict go forth from him, and let it be written among the laws of Persia and Medea that it is not be revoked, that Vashti not come before King Ahasuerus, and that the king give her royal crown to another that is better than she. Uta tova mimena. Now, we're not sure if she was dead or not, if she was killed or not. According to the Midrash, she was killed. We don't know. Some would say she was only like expelled. She was only like, he divorced her. We're not sure what really happened because the Megillah doesn't tell us. All right? And and the king's decree which he shall make shall be heard throughout his kingdom, through it is vast, and all the wives will give honor to their husbands, from great to small. And the words pleased the king and the officers, and the king did according to the word of Memuchan. It's supposed to be the opposite. Memuchan did according to the word of the king. Right? The king does. Who's the king and who's the servant here? Right? Like, we're not sure. That will happen later with Haman and with Mordechai. We'll see all that it happens over and over again. He sent, the last verse, he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to their writing, and to each people according to their language, that each man should rule in his own house and speak according to the language of his people. In other words, he knew there can be intermarriage between this and this, and the woman speaks English, and the husband speaks French, and they should speak French in their house, not English. All right, that was what he said. That's how the first chapter ends. Now, what do I think we should gain from that before we finish, before we talk? What do I think we should, what did we achieve in that sense here, right, when we talk about this? So, first of all, we understand the introduction of the setting. What are we talking about? What is the timeline, right? Like, where exactly are we talking? We're talking about Jews, the rich, educated, high-class society, the Jews that decided they want to stay close to the throne in Shushan, the capital, close to the king, with all the royalty, with all the majesty, with all the rich food and dishes and festivals and feasts, right? We know that their fellow brothers, the poor ones, those who are less educated, the lower classes of society, went back to Israel and built Beit HaMikdash HaShini, and they went up with Ezra and Nehemiah. I didn't mention it, but those are the books in Tanakh. We talk about Ezra and Nehemiah, the two leaders that went with the people back to Israel and built the second temple, which at the beginning was very, very, very poor. It was very ugly, right? There's a major saying that the second temple before Herodias, before King Herod, came and renovated it. It was like the ugliest thing in the world, and afterwards it was the most beautiful thing. They didn't have money. They were like workers, and they just built whatever they could. So their fellow brothers, the rich and educated, did not join them. They stayed in Shushan. And we know that in that sense, the Jews who were there were very, 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 I would say, a problem. Now, I think why is it important for us to know and to end the chapter with the story of Vashti? Because Esther and Mordechai are not here yet. Why is it important for us to know? And now she said, I did bring the source that I mentioned before, and I want to see it again. Look in source, in the last source of the page, of the book. Source number 12. The Gemara says as follows. His disciples asked Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, why did the enemies of Israel, in other words, it's a nice way to call Jews who misbehaved, all right, they're the enemies of Israel, are actually Jews who misbehaved, why in that generation, the generation of Mordechai and Esther, deserved extermination? What happened? What was their sin? And he said to them, you answer. They said, because they enjoyed the feast of that wicked one, Ahasuerus. The Gemara tells you, you know why everything happened? Because they joined the Ahasuerus in the field. Ahasuerus invited them, and they said yes and came. Who Ahasuerus invited and said no? Vashti. Vashti is the alter ego, is the opposite to all Jews in Shushan. She is the example of someone that was invited to the feast and said no. That's the reason I want to claim, I want to argue, the reason that we finished the entire story here is to tell us, you know what's going to happen next? Everything's going to happen next is because those Jews did not behave like Vashti. If they would have said no like Vashti, that's not going to happen. Everything we're going to see was not going to happen. They were all punished because they wanted and said yes to participate. And there is one woman, one queen, Vashti, and she is the granddaughter of the one of the worst people in the world to the Jewish people, and she is the one that said no. So how could the Jews said yes? We don't know what happened to Vashti. The Gemara said that Vashti was killed, but we don't know it. According to the Megillah, again, if we go shot-wise and we see the plain text, the simple plain text, what happened to her? Nothing. Nothing happened to her according to the plain text. So why did the Jews not behave like this? Okay, there's Midrash, maybe she was killed, she was divorced, so on. Where are they? Why did they say yes and Vashti said no? And we'll try to answer all those questions also next week. That's the first chapter. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, because it's less introduction, more text. We'll do two halves. First half, we're going to do chapter 2. Second half, we'll do chapter 3. And I really hope that all of you here that came now will also be able to join us next week and the weeks afterwards. Thank you very much for coming tonight. And just make sure to take this with you. And I very much recommend bringing it with you, the timeline. Also next week. And in general, bring it for Purim. Put it in your Megillah. I would just say, I would just say,